Hello and welcome to this discussion session on the ghost of Richard III by Christopher Brooke. I am your host, Robert Crichton, and I am here primarily as a really gratuitous plug for my own work. In a week's time, less than a week's time by the time this podcast goes out, I will be performing a live video stream of a performance of this poem, The Ghost of Richard III, from the Key Theatre in Sudbury. We've been working on this show for a little over a month now, and it's based on, honestly, this particular poem that we're going to be talking about today, but we're also going to be talking about other Richard III's. Other Richard III's are available. And I came across this text and these other texts that we may be looking at also in the future, thanks to going to the Changing Histories conference. Was it last year? Was it earlier than that? I forget. Time is getting very flexible these days. And having gone to that lovely conference, heard a wonderful paper about Richard and these works, and was inspired to dig them out immediately and see if I could plunder them to turn them into a show. And lo and behold, so it has come to pass. I say it is all down to my wonderful guest here today, as who I'm going to ask, introduce yourself and your wonderfulness.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. I am Jitka Štolová. I am a Title A Fellow in English Literature at Trinity College, Cambridge. And I work on the portrayals of Richard III in the 17th century.
Excellent. So, as I say, there's a spectrum of texts that we can look at. There's one I can think of that I think many people will know, but there are also lots and lots of other bits and pieces available. So could you, as a sort of opening gambit, talk through some of those and also your relationship with them as well? How did you end up looking at this material?
Well, I must say it has been a very long story. It all started for me in Prague during my undergraduate studies, where I focused on that Richard III you're thinking of. And then for my master's, which I also completed at Charles University, I was looking at the pre-Shakespearean portraits of Richard III as a definition of about a century of portrayals, which really spans the very exciting and very turbulent decades right after the Battle of Bosworth, 1485, the moment when Richard's posthumous reputation started unfolding following his death. And for my PhD, which I completed at Trinity College, Cambridge, I looked at those portrayals in the 17th century. And I was also following this project during my first junior research fellowship at Jesus College, Oxford. And then I went back to Cambridge to complete this as a postdoctoral project. So I'm currently working on a monograph covering this idea, Richard as a reflection of a historical figure, and also Richard as a myth, as it were. And I should also add that I'm simultaneously editing a bilingual edition of Richard III, English, Czech, and that's also very exciting to see how that works at the intersection of two languages.
So you're talking about the intersection between history and myth, but then there's a difference to some degree with what they considered history then to what we today might consider a more accurate or a different interpretation of events. And so the texts are sort of doing a dance with that. Is that a fair generalization?
Absolutely. That's one of the interesting things you have with this character. He is very liminal, very extreme in perceptions. Tyrant, usurper, murderer, you have it. Mm. But also you can examine on the shifts, slight shifts that happen with his perception, how history was understood and how that mythology was understood. So it feels really significant. I'm not necessarily speaking about those shifts from the black to the white legend, those really big, strong views one might have, but it's the slight things that really become much more prominent in the 17th century than they do previously. So that was partly the reason why I focused on this period, because suddenly you examine that symbol of tyranny through new historical circumstances and also in a obviously fresh light of an evolving literary tradition. And also art, that's another thing I look at, the way he was portrayed, not just in paintings, but also engravings, woodcuts. And it's a fascinating story that becomes just not as straightforward as one might perhaps expect necessarily.
So obviously we know of one quite famous play version. We have been reading in the, as part of our exploring sessions, we've been reading The True Tragedy of Richard III as well. This session is all about the ghost of Richard III. What other Richard III's are available, shall we say, text-wise?
Right. The story starts mainly, well, it starts with ballads and then with chronicles, Polydor, Virgil, one of the early sources that we have, and of course Thomas More, that becomes super influential, but unfinished. So when the chroniclers such as Holinshed start taking over the text, they obviously added, there were loads of other people playing with the story. We also have a Latin play, university drama, which was performed right next doors to me at St. John's, Cambridge, over three nights, a hugely long play, and everyone was involved, I think, except for the bedmakers, I'm sure, because otherwise the cast list doesn't make any sense. So it was a big story of, you know, behold what will happen to you if you become a tyrant. Don't do it. A really important moment came with poetry. Richard always had that poetic incarnation. I mentioned ballads already, something like the Song of Lady Bessie, which shows him as a tyrant, unsurprisingly. That's very early on. But really something which is very important for our text today is a tradition of poetic collections called the Mirror for Magistrates. That was a hugely influential collection of poems, first published 1559, and then it went through loads of reprints and loads of editions. And it basically contained, well, speeches, almost soliloquies of various historic characters who emerge out of hell, come say, you know, look at me, what happened to me, don't do it, or pity me and also don't do it. And then they go down to hell. And Richard emerged as one of those characters in a poem which was remarkably not good. Even the original editors were not quite sure whether to include it. And then someone said, oh, actually, but the subject matter is so crooked that it would not be fit if he had a nice poem in which he would feature. So a good way to get away with poor verse, as it were.
I sorry, I love that. I love that. That's an idea of just going, yeah, well, the character's not very nice, so yeah, I can phone it in this week. That'll be fine.
Absolutely. Well, and it's nice to see that it began to be seen as a bit of a problem, or at least some people in the 17th century thought, well, let's revisit it. And they didn't necessarily paint it in more positive colors. As I said, for me, it's not a dichotomy of good, bad, but certainly some better poetry. And one piece which influenced our Christopher Brooke was a new edition of The Mirror for Magistrates, 1610, so only 4 years before this poem was published. And it features new Richard, and very much in that idea of the rise and fall of great princes who turn tyrants. And this is one of the threads that we can recognize in the ghost of Richard III. So interestingly, in the second decade of the 17th century, we have two spectral incarnations of Richard III.
So yes, I think should we start talking about the ghost of Richard III, the poem itself. I'm performing it in a cut down version of this complete narrative from dragged out to hell. He tells his life story from the cradle to the grave, and then returns conveniently back to hell again, and goes through quite a journey. So it was written by Christopher Brooke. What do we know about him, his life, his background, or Why do we know anything about why he was drawn to this particular tale?
It's quite a fascinating set of circumstances, actually, because Christopher Brooke was not, his first description would not be a poet. He was a member of parliament for York. And his poem was, it really emerged out of a coincidence of political pressures and also just interest in poetry that was generated by his social background. I should say that this poem really is fascinating, and it did get a bit of attention from literary scholars. Michelle O'Callaghan has done some wonderful work, and also Philip Switzer, but it still remains, a lot remains to be said about it. So it's wonderful that it gets its own stage within this project. So why did he write it? Well, when we think of Christopher Brooke, we should imagine a person who is very well educated, possibly educated in Cambridge, then he became a lawyer, then he joined Parliament, and he was also very much in touch with the literary culture of London. He forged very solid friendship with John Donne. They were actually neighbors for quite a bit of time. They lived on the same street in London. He knew Ben Jonson, who contributed one of the commendatory poems. We know that among his friends was Inigo Jones, the famous architect and mask designer, as it were. So a really interesting intersection. That was the literary part. So he was really drawn to it, but he didn't publish much, actually. This is the most substantial piece. There are a few other bits, other pieces of literature where he might have contributed, but this is the most solid bit. The other part...
Sorry, yes. I just wanted to just jump in, because you mentioned the sort of dedicatory poems at the beginning of the text. Now, is this a good time to sort of jump in on that? Because you mentioned Ben Jonson. And all these others, there's a lot of material there, but it's a real mix as well, that I find absolutely fascinating. I particularly like Ben Jonson's, and being placed as the last in the selection, I think that's because he doesn't write a long poem, does old Ben. To his friend the author upon his Richard, when these and such their voices have employed, what place is for my testimony void? You know, it's a sort of, I've everybody else has already spoken, I don't need to say more. Will that do?
Absolutely. No, and some very good names. I mean, Ben Jonson, possibly the most recognizable one, but we also have George Chapman. We have a few others. But yes, I do agree with you that Jonson's poem is curious. It comes at the end, and it's also, it's good, and the subject is intriguing. The last two lines are really quite striking. I would wonder whether you would be able to read them out.
My suffrage brings thee all increase to crown thy Richard, raised in song, past pulling down.
This is brilliant. So we have Ben Jonson crowning Richard III ultimately in that reputation quality of the poem. And of course, this is so fascinating because we know that Ben Jonson, he was paid to write a play called Richard Crookback. Either he wrote it and it was lost, or he didn't finish it. We don't know. But this is one of a few cases when Ben Jonson writes a commendatory poem on a poem about Richard III. The other one is going to be John Beaumont. And we can see glimpses of Jonson's thinking about the subject. So yes, tyrant, all that, but also certain greatness, that to crown thy Richard raised in song past pulling down. That's a very decent endorsement, I think.
Mm. It's interesting. We looked at a while ago on the podcast, Mortimer, his fall, or, you know, what survives of that. You know, he didn't finish it, and to a degree barely started it. But the way he portrays Mortimer in that feels very similar vein. You know, he's this difficult figure who, you know, is both potentially villain and also praiseworthy. And it really, that connection I seem to recall is, it feels really interesting within that idea of things that Ben Johnson might have been drawn to, and then some things survive, some don't.
I would just add that it's important to remember that this is published in 1614, big year in history, the year of the adult parliament, so-called by James I, who basically, he as well as his son are going to have huge problems with generating money. They just can't function very well in terms of finance. And that's a moment when he summons the parliament, tries to generate extra taxes. And here the really heated problem, and the years before that, was something called the impositions. It was basically the right to impose extra taxes on things that you would import. And taxation was normally seen as privilege of parliament. And the king was saying, no, that's my privilege. And it really generated a lot of problems. We see the debates that are going on with, you know, Charles I later on. They very much had roots at that time. And here it is, a member of parliament who made a few speeches, they are recorded, where he really is very keen to maintain the independence of parliament. Yes, recognizing the strong power of the monarch, but not absolute power. And one way of seeing this poem, or one element of it, is that warning against tyranny and absolute power and the twisting of law. And that's really important for the context of the poem.
The question of tyrants is something that very much appeals to a lot of writers from the early modern period. Something about a monarchy will do that, I think.
Very much so, yeah. Richard will end up being a very useful example for very different parties. So when we reach the Civil War, you will have both the parliamentarians and the royalists somehow finding something in the story that they can claim for themselves. So he becomes super, super flexible as a historical example.
The poem itself, where do we start with the poem itself? Probably at the beginning. So he's dragged from hell, and he's not desperately happy about this process. You know, he's full of pain and fire and this sense of regret, you know, almost anguish at having to, you know, once again look at a land who everybody hates him, before he then is, through a sort of slightly bizarre and terrifying ritual of drinking from the wittiest politician's skull, which I absolutely love. His maze are filled with Stygian juice brimful, and innocent blood fit for an ebon bowl. I quaff to all damned spirits. And then he tells his life story. So, you know, for you, that opening and what's happening with the character of Richard?
I will start by saying that one thing which really will become something we will be repeating a lot coming back to is that this Richard is really intelligent, really witty. Not all Richards would be, as it were, in the tradition. For example, for Ricardus Tertius, yeah, I think there could be a debate. This one is smart and he knows it, and we shall see that when he falls in that intellectual sense, as well as the physical one and the moral one. I love the way this Richard is drawing attention to the artificiality of his creation, as it were. He is rising as a spectre. He is showing this is a literary creation, and he revisits the moment he was conceived, all the myths we have about Richard, the peculiar natural phenomena that occurred to highlight someone really strange is coming to the world. But he uses two interesting words. He says that at his conception, there was imagination and seed. We have the physical and the metaphysical. So really, he is describing the conception of his own myth, as well as the historical Richard that he's talking about. That's a wonderful insight, and shows that sort of meta quality that this Richard has over his story, which is relatively unique in the canon.
The reason why it's working for me as a performable text is that he is talking to an audience. He's talking to a reading audience, But it's not like, because we've got the or one of the other texts we've got, you know, the rising to the crown of Richard by himself, which feels slightly different. Here, it's not like you're feeling like he's sitting down and writing it. Here, it feels like it's coming direct to us. You know, in my case, obviously as a performance, but you know, even on the text, it doesn't feel like he's sat down and written it, or you know, or he hasn't got an amanuensis. It's coming direct at us. And that has an immediacy to it. And I think you're right, the intelligence aspect, he's had 100+ years to think about his life. Don't know how time works in hell. And he really goes into the details. I mean, the bit that leapt out at me when we first read it, and this is material that will come out on the podcast eventually, is when he's talking about, in his childhood, with delight, I taught my nature to see fowls to bleed. You know, it seems almost a decision to go out and see horrible things and train himself to be a monster. And that I absolutely found fascinating.
Absolutely. This is, I think, one of the most unique features of this particular text, because that's always the problem we have with this story, that where does the character begin and end, and where does the framework of historiography begin and end? And this Richard seems to be conscious of it. I think that quality of looking back has something to do with it. And he offers a sort of an explanation. Of course, at one level, it works as an allegory, as we said, as a warning for tyrants. Yes. So this is one way to frame it. But there is almost an element of exaggeration. There are a few details that we find. For example, the way the legend of Richard's physical distortion is amplified. It's interesting. This story, this Richard, I mean, he's spectral. He shouldn't be that physical, although the title page does show his face as remarkably aged. But we don't get a systematic exploitation of the idea of disability. Mm. But then we have moments which never happened before in any other text. And I do think that there might be a bit tongue-in-cheek, I don't know, when he speaks about the that hollow my cheeks, upon my breast black hair. Yeah. We don't normally have Richard with hairy chest, born as a baby. We have Richard who is born with teeth and with legs forward, yes. But this is quite a unique amplification of the legend. And I wonder whether it's serious or not.
Well, it's a thing. If he's being told this kind of thing from the off, and it's because the way it then leaks straight into this going to see animals, dead animals, playing with their entrails, you know, the sense of, well, everyone's telling me I'm a monster. Well, let's have a go at it. Let's practice. Let's see. And that leads on to going to watch executions and going to, and there's an element where I was thinking of it again on that psychological vent of going, well, he's a bit like you see with some psychopaths, where they train themselves to, you know, to demonstrate emotion and demonstrate things. And this goes into a lot of detail about learning to, I mean, he's not a psychopath. He teaches himself to be emotionally distant and enjoy pain in others. And there's sort of a mix. He's as much, it seems that he's made, and though there is a conscious decision to make himself, it's everybody telling him things rather than necessarily being true, those things about him. I don't know, I'm starting to roll with ideas rather than things that I thought about much in different forms. So I will stop now.
Well, I think this is really very relevant, and it is a constant problem in that story, as it were, story of Richard. Do you show it as a failure, exceptional failure of an individual person, a bad person, or something which is imposed by the way the story of history developed? Mm. And this particular Richard seems to be able to see the contours of that, go right round the edges of it. So he is doing both, and in a very clever way. And that agency he has in training himself, I taught, I learned, I observed, all that. That's really, he is his own author in some ways, but very much conscious of the mold within which he needs to fit. And that intelligence we see, he really is creating. Of course, he's. This is also a travesty on the, you know, educated prince, humanist prince, who should be ticking all the good boxes, and he is sort of ticking all the bad boxes. So there is that irony as well. But I think this is, yeah, this is all but a very simplistic parody on an example. It's doing so much more beyond the surface. And I would just say that the idea of Richard and blood, that's an interesting one. It's a long motif. And you mentioned the two tragedy of Richard III, which has a fascinating moment at one point when Richard totally loses it after a long soliloquy. And he indulges in this idea of basically drinking Richmond's blood, one of the most bloodthirsty moments in any of the texts. Here he observes that blood, although later on he will have moments when he also gets that primeval excitement of touching, getting in touch with blood. But it's, yeah, it's always fascinating to observe in texts when he's accused of being bloodthirsty and when he actually does it. Because here he does it in the way people get university education.
Yes. yes, and you know, he does get an education as well, and he's not very, you know, standard education. He talks about that briefly, and he's sort of going, yeah, I wasn't that, you know, I did it. But he's, you know, it's clearly what he knows, it's not important to his life story almost, you know. It's like he knew he needed to train himself in the in that other school of wisdom, or in a school of darkness, to get where he wants to be. You know, he's already talking about the crown, the seat, you know, getting higher.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And he really emphasizes not theoretical studying. Again, we might think this is the time when something like the Book of the Courtier, the manual, how to be a good courtier, is quite popular. And he really focuses on the practical skills. He is going to read the entrails, which of course was a great skill in the ancient world. Then he goes to courtrooms, observes how judges make judgments, sentences, and then he goes to the execution places to get used to all of that and get rid of any potential for pity, just to stifle that element of humanity he might have.
And he uses all of those skills to teach himself to, you know, to personate, to give the, you know, his face is forged in tempered like brass, he can control his tongue. And even when he goes further and he's talking about, you know, going into court and scurrying around and looking at the world there, it's all observing, it's all watching what people higher up the pecking order do, and how their counselors fawn on them, and learning how to work people. It's also, he has a very firm theoretical basis about what he's doing and why he's got. And the poem does a lot more than that than I'll be doing in the show, because, you know, there's a fundamental difference between a poem and a performance. But that's something that really actually is enjoyable to read about, actually. You know, it's where it says a poem works better as a poem than in performance, because I actually really like some of those thoughts about where, you know, difference between virtues and what's in ascendancy, and what will get you more power, and what works for you and what works against you. I was sort of pained to trim, but you have to in an adaptation.
Absolutely. Well, I can see that this would be a necessity, but it's just to mention it here briefly, the, you know, as you mentioned, the influence of colleges and schools, but also religion, that's going to be important towards the end of the story, how very cynical he becomes about that. He professed that but didn't have the reverence in heart. So he is, as you say, using all that he can use to get where he needs to be.
What you haven't mentioned is the poem is structured in three parts, and that's broadly speaking. The first part is very much about you know, his birth, his nativity, and is titled His Character. So it's very much setting up all those stalls before getting too much into what we might call plot, as it were, the legend of Richard III. And here we sort of enter the Wars of the Roses, basically, don't we, with a vengeance. And he loses his father quite early on, and does his first murder as well. Always nice to get that in nice and early. So thoughts about that opening of the legend?
That's the moment when Christopher Brooke most recognizes the impact of Shakespeare, the influence of the story, and we will find multiple echoes, metaphorical echoes, as it were. But still, there is that interesting twisting. You know, he opens by addressing Shakespeare directly to him, but then he reaches a moment when he says, "Oh, yeah, you know, this was really significant thing that boosted my fame, and who with my actions dignified his pen." And that feels like a very lovely compliment until we realize that he dignified his pen, Shakespeare dignified his pay, with Richard's actions. So Richard is almost saying, well, you wrote a really good play thanks to what I did. That's a very nice twisting of it. But no, it's very, very complimentary. And he's wondering, so where is my space when there is this wonderful stage, very tantalizing stage incarnation? What should I do? And he says, okay, my task is to inform this ignorant age. So again, we are going back to the idea of intellect, information, education.
It moves forward and it does pick up things that are very, very explicit in the Shakespeare, the letter G, George, all those details. The way Buckingham is threaded into the narrative is very much from there. It's Buckingham in here is very fits within that framework, whereas the Buckingham of, say, the True Tragedy is very different. I mean, if anyone hasn't listened to or watched our videos on the True Tragedy, it is a truly fascinating play. But Buckingham here is constantly talked about, you know, my hand, my friend. But I love the way it said, now steal back to Buckingham, I made my friend, him I sustained with hope and fed with air. He's not offering him much, is he?
No. Buckingham is one of those people who help him rise to power. Although I wonder whether we haven't really spoken about sources to this. I wonder whether Brooke read one particular work of history that would have been quite recent back then by John Speed, who speaks about Buckingham as the prime actor who helped Richard rise. So Buckingham gets much more agency. Mm. He is not just the second person next to him. And I think there are traces of that here, at least in that, yeah, in that idea. You know, he does mention the wings and the desire of soaring. So the words I use, but yeah, here Richard, he's that intelligent person. But I think the question of agency, you know, how do tyrants happen? Is it their supreme wicked intellect, or is it the combination of all the factors around them and everyone is sort of complicit by not speaking out? That's the question this poem is asking, among many others.
I mean, it's interesting the way Brooke talks about anyone who is opposition as, you know, just going, well, they're idiots, you know, because they weren't very strong. I mean, I don't have the line in front of me, but I think it's when talking about Grey Rivers at Vaughan, you know, fighting me when they weren't strong, you know, right, it has nothing then, you know, and it can't win, and they were idiots, and Hastings to a degree ends up in the same boat as well. He's, you know, if you don't have a power base, you see, I've trained myself from an early age, I know how to do this game, you don't. And I find that really interesting. And the poem really goes into that sort of theatrical thing from Richard's life of, you know, putting out to the public the arguments let's get rid of these princes. They're illegitimate, honest. Where's the birth certificate? Kind of thing. And he's got his own mouthpiece in Dr. Shaw, who I absolutely adore.
It's lovely how this bit with Shaw arguing, really, you know, everyone is Alice's illegitimate is just Richard. And he, the poem rehearses that stumbling and the repetition and the coming to the cue, which is actually something that Thomas More writes about. And we don't have it in The True Tragedy, for example. There's something super theatrical even in the original, big quotation marks, original story of Richard III, and the orchestration of power and public performance that really tries to convince the public that this is the right way forward. The poem is very conscious of that power.
Yes, I'm very aware that I had to trim elements of this, which slightly distorts its meaning. So that sense of he's supposed to come on cue and then he doesn't is a bit late, and the whole thing's a bit of a disaster. It's a bit, it doesn't go very well. Which it's really nice in the poem, and I absolutely adored. But it was a case of, I have to apologise to Christopher Book that we needed to move the narrative forward. So it was moderately successful, and in the end, and we go straight to Buckingham doing the same but with different people. I love the way he talks about the wise wealthy magistrates. I like that as a combination. It's not the, you know, are they wise or are they just, no, they're wealthy. They're wealthy. And the way it's actually laid out there is, it's just going, it's almost like he just goes, wise, wealth. It's like he deliberately stops saying the word wise. And I absolutely adore that.
The following line, such they were then, or whatever they are now, again, we really are reminded of the context of the problems of James the First's reign and the disillusionment that people feel. So yeah, history is sort of compressed now and then, maybe happening at the same time. You can see the present moment through the prism of the past and realize something really important about what's going on with you right now.
And it's obviously he gets the crown and then everything gets much darker. And it becomes much more internalized because he's, you know, he contemplates killing the princes. And obviously that's where his relationship with Buckingham goes downhill and he has to find Tyrrell to organize the murders for him. But from that point onwards, that sense of the walls closing in on the character seems to be increased. And we move towards, by the time that he kills the princes, he sort of has a nervous breakdown in the text. So any thoughts on sort of in that sort of direction of Tyrrell, the murder, and then that closing in?
Well, absolutely. This is a absolutely fundamental moment in the story. And it has always been portrayed like that. You know, going back to Polydor Virgil, there is that moment of crisis once he reaches the crown and then it goes downhill. But here it's really realized as a intellectual, moral, even physical breakdown. And I feel one thing which Brooke does very interestingly is that he not only creates this as a pressure of conscience, which it is also that, but it's not just that. It's also Richard at that point when he organizes the murder and he becomes very poetic about the description of the princess. It's almost as if he was there. He sees them being very innocent and dying. But then he suddenly becomes much more shallow, much more superficial. And that peak, that rise and fall in that de casibus on fall parameter, which, as I said, is related to the mirror for magistrates framework and all that, here is heightened by that intellect. So when we think about it, right before Richard, when he is still on the rise, he is giving himself advice how to be a successful, well, Machiavellian. One of the things he's saying, you know, make political allies. Another thing, don't grant petitions. It's going to be really costly. Another thing, don't show emotions. Don't be readable. And what happens right afterwards when he gains the crown? He turns against Buckingham. He destroys that alliance. Then he asks Tyrrell to kill the princes who is a very self-interested sycophant, we could say. And ultimately, he loses control over his behavior. He becomes readable. So I think the reason why, for me, this fall in Brooks's ghost is so sharp is because he falls not just according to the pre-existing parameters of the genre. He falls from his own preconceived greatness, as it were. There were ideas that he rejects, which he himself constructed.
It's an interesting thing that this may be more a performance thing adding on to a text, but when he starts talking about the princes and he talk about all the presaging storms and all the stuff around that, and then he starts effectively victim blaming them by going, well, they knew it was coming. They were there, they saw the print, they knew, and there's a sort of weird, you know, the angry comet thirsted to be fed with their heart's blood. They knew these storms should cease, almost like it's their fault. And then when he's talking about the grooms, the two Tyrrell gets to actually do the murder itself, and he says, you know, they're chased by furies or something, tortured with despair and howl in horror of their murderous deed. And in my mind, that's him. That's him. He's projecting that onto somebody else. And that's something because that leads straight into this long discussion of losing control of himself bodily as well as mentally. He's talking about he has a total breakdown. And there's something very lived about that and very detailed that I find really interesting.
No, absolutely. The moment when before he has this breakdown, he has one of the most wonderful lines for me in the poem, when he is trapped in these doubts and then has that, "No, Richard, in thine own power still be free." The declaration of complete independence and justification of what he has done for himself, which is so important for his intellect. And then it just goes absolutely downhill, as you explained, both intellectually and physically, into some very, very, very striking, gruesome details.
Well, it's the fact that he talks himself into killing the princes in stages as well. You know, he's actually essentially has a demon on his shoulder talking him into it. Really fun to perform. And so even that journey into the killing the princes, it's the conception of a thought happening quite a long way. And he knows it's a dark and evil and terrible thing to do even at that early stage. So it's really nicely woven. I really like it. It makes this section quite hard to cut because it is so nicely put together. And you know, kudos.
It builds up quite a striking momentum. As he's falling deeper and deeper, and I think deeper than some previous Richards, as it were, because he reaches that moment when he really asks himself what conscience is, isn't it? And there, the question, again, I mean, it's hard not to think of what will come later in Milton's Satan and the rejection of God.
Yes, because he's there going, you know, I've gone too far. There are some lovely lines when he's talking about, you know, he could go and beg and cry and do all these things. It's not going to make the blindest bit of difference.
We could again draw a comparison between this moment here in this poem and the true tragedy. There's that wonderful soliloquy where he suddenly experiences the entire nature conspiring against him for revenge. So there is an element of fear, of consequence. This Richard goes deeper, he falls deeper and becomes much more sophisticated because he recognizes, when he wants to, he says, even eating, you know, eat into marble, even that wouldn't be enough. He rejects the grace of God. He realizes, just like Milton's Satan, that the hell is himself. And out of that, he doesn't manage to dig himself out. And that's really, I think he falls possibly the deepest of the Richards I have read about, where he again, almost rises in a dark way, in the sense that he takes the role of God in judging whether he is still eligible for God's mercy, which of course is a sin and you shouldn't do it. And he does. It's, again, if I was to point that should be invoked, Shakespeare's Hamlet, when Claudius falls to his knees, tries to find that repentance and can't because he still enjoys the benefit of it. This Richard goes further. He rejects that idea because he feels he is beyond the possibility of grace. Deep darkness in his soul. There is that heaven in him. I saw this hell my thoughts had shaped and bred. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Rejection, self-rejection almost. Again, the intellect doing all the dark things instead of God, as it were, instead of history, instead of judgment. It's Richard. It's self-scripted.
Because by this point, we are into the narrative of Richmond is coming. You know, it's not just internal foes that he's fighting as well. There's just that on the distance, there is this potential rival who's coming. And of course, we all know where it's going to go. and we're moving towards the final curtain as we go into the sort of the final section of the poem, with the as we head towards the Battle of Bosworth. I really like Richard's descriptions of how he can't really trust his own men because they don't love him. These are a company of frozen hearts, you know, and he's having to bribe some of them really quite extravagantly to stay on board, as well as, you know, hold some people hostage as well. Whereas everyone loves Richmond. Everyone loves Richmond, isn't he great? So yeah, it's that building of that sense of despair. You know, he's pulled out of himself by war rather than by recovery, as it were, from his cogitations.
And again, we get the sense of gruesome ending. That's another moment after Richard falls, as it were, we didn't really speak about it, did we? But the sense of physical disintegration here at the end of the death, at the end of the battle, it becomes the brain that spills out of his skull.
Oh yes, it's I find performing that it weirdly is almost dispassionate. In a weird way, it's like he's standing and looking at himself. I this may be a projection onto the text, but it's just they charactered in wounds my tyranny and thus performed my bloody tragedy. And so my brain they dashed, which flew on every side as they would. And he gives examples for each one of how he sort of deserves it, you know, and there's knowledge there, which he perhaps didn't have at the very beginning. Spoilers, by the way, everyone. He dies at Bosworth. He doesn't win. And I mean, the battle itself is actually quite swift. There isn't that much battle action, and it moves with a right lick. You know, once signal is given, it just goes on and on and on and on, and all these images of blood and swords in flesh do sheathe. You know, these very aggressive images that we're getting. Following on from this dream sequence, which possibly we may have seen elsewhere in form before, but yeah, we get to that final death, and I mean, do disagree? That's just how I'm sort of playing with it in performance, and you know, it's slightly out of some of the context because I've cut the text.
I think that's a very astute reading what you're saying, that he looks again at himself, his fate, his historical fate, and the way it was depicted in the sources. And it's nice to see Brooke being quite precise about quite a few things. The fact that, you know, he takes down Brendan, who was on Richmond's side, so he has that detail of a name. Yeah, we would find that in Holinshed. The fact that he died not in a one-on-one combat. He was overwhelmed. Again, accurate. And of course, the brain, I mean, that's a very nice detail for us post 2013 when they found him, because now we know that he died by having a very severe head trauma. Mm.
Yes, almost all the details there feel accurate. It seems like quite a good representation of it all. So that's kind of why I went with the clinical nature. I mean, in a different universe, you know, if I was using projection and doing all sorts of things, you know, you'd have X-ray images and, you know, stuff from the actual archaeology would actually be quite interesting to mix in with this, because there isn't much in this where I'm sitting and going, yeah, we don't quite think that anymore. It's all mostly the spin, which is the that element. Then he's dragged to hell.
Absolutely, yes. And back to our imagination. And I mean that, just to briefly stay with the idea of that brain spilling over, I was checking this and it's peculiar that we don't have that many original sources that would mention it. Mm. That particular detail. It occurs in the Song of Lady Bessie, which I said was very, very early, basically from the late 1480s, right after the battle. There is a detail of that. But then with the dramatic sources we mentioned, they don't really show it. And the chronicles, they mention that he was dragged on a horse, here also implied, but mentioned in fact, but not the detail with the skull. Mm. We have it with John Beaumont, and now we have it in a photograph of that skeleton that was unearthed, and that shows it very precisely. So we may wonder whether it was, you know, conjecture, or was there any sort of popular knowledge of that battle lingering over, which didn't make it into the chronicles, but would come out as metaphorical details. Who knows? But it's striking, absolutely arresting, spilling of the brain.
And because as we're on Bosworth, of course, there is the other variation we haven't mentioned, I think, explicitly. I think you mentioned Beaumont, but I don't think we've actually mentioned the title. But there is another poem called Bosworth Field, which is, again, very, very performable and something that I'm looking at as a future thing for more of an ensemble piece. But that's another wonderful part of these interweaving texts, because that's full of detail. This battle is very short, but Bosworth Field is it's got all the action and too many names. Actually, this doesn't have, this is very, very spare with names. You know, it focuses on characters quite precisely and very well, I have to say. Final thoughts about this, anything we haven't covered so far with the ghost of Richard III?
I'm sure we could sit here for hours discussing individual details, because there's so much in the poem in terms of classical allusions, very interesting, arresting details, echoes of different sources that were incorporated into and played with and slightly changed. There is so much. It's a wonderful poem. Really, really witty, very intelligent, written by a witty writer and creating a very smart, dark Richard. I like it.
And yes, obviously, I want you all to go and watch the performance that I'll be doing, and maybe performances in the distant future if we come back to this text. But also go and there will be links in the show notes. Go and read the poem. It's a really interesting work. And there's a lot there that obviously you won't get from my performance. Further down the line, we will do a full audio reading of the text. I don't know who's going to be reading that or how we're going to do that yet, but that's something that will happen further down the line, because I think we can pick out more of the stuff that has had to be cut for time and narrative flow and performance-y things. So there will be links in the show notes to go out and read for yourself. Make up your own decision. Make up your own mind about how you find the ghost of poor Richard III.
I think I will just end by mentioning one particular description of Richard of himself, which I think is really, it encapsulates the increasing progression of his spirit, that my inward darkness. We are here in this poem to examine that inward darkness of Richard and the remarkable torments that his soul could be seen as experiencing.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me for this episode. Links to everything in the show notes, and a safe performance hopefully will be existing very soon for you to watch online, either live or recorded and stored on some sort of internet thing. I'd say once again, thank you very much, Ika, for your time.
And thank you for inviting me.
And goodbye.